Part 4. Paradise Regained. Chapter 14. A Brief History of Psychedelics. Psychedelic plants and experience were first suppressed by European civilization, then ignored and forgotten. The 4th century witnessed the suppression of the mystery religions, the cults of Bacchus and Diana, of Attis and Cybele. The rich syncretism that was typical of the Hellenistic world had become a thing of the past. Christianity triumphed over the Gnostic sects. Valentinians, Marcionites, and others, which were the last bastions of paganism. These repressive episodes in the evolution of Western thought effectively closed the door on communication with a Gaian mind. Hierarchically imposed religion and later hierarchically dispensed scientific knowledge were submitted for any sort of direct experience of the mind behind nature. The intoxicants of the Christian dominator culture, whether plants or synthetic drugs, were inevitably stimulants or narcotics. Drugs of the workplace or drugs to dull care and pain. Drugs in the 20th century serve only medical or recreational purposes. Yet even the West has retained the thin thread of remembrance of the archaic, hierophantic, and ecstatic potential that certain plants hold. The survival through long centuries in Europe of witchcraft and rites involving psychoactive plants attests that the gnosis of entering parallel dimensions by altering brain chemistry was never entirely lost. The plants of European witchcraft, thorn apple, mandrake, and nightshade, did not contain indole hallucinogens, but were nevertheless capable of inducing intense altered states of consciousness. The archaic connection of feminism to a magical dimension of risk and power was clearly perceived as a threat by the medieval church. As late as the Middle Ages, the witch was still the Hagazusa, a being that sat on the hag, the fence, which passed behind the gardens and separated the village from the wilderness. She was a being who participated in both worlds. As we might say today, she was semi-demonic. In time, however, she lost her double features and evolved more and more into a representation of what was being expelled from culture, only to return distorted in the night. That these plants were the basis for entry into other dimensions was the result of the relative paucity in Europe of hallucinogen-containing species. The New World Hallucinogens. Indole-containing plant hallucinogens and their cults cluster in the tropical New World. The New World's subtropical and tropical zones are phenomenally rich in hallucinogenic plants. Similar ecosystems in the Southeast Asian and Indonesian tropics cannot compare in numbers of endemic species that contain psychoactive indoles. Why are the Old World tropics, the tropics of Africa and Indonesia, not equally rich in hallucinogenic flora? No one has been able to answer this question. But statistically speaking, the New World seems to be the preferred home of the more powerful psychoactive plants. Psilocybin, while now known to occur in European species of diminutive mushrooms of the genus Psilocybe, has never been convincingly shown to have been a part of European shamanism or ethnomedicine. Yet its shamanic use in Oaxacan Mexico is 3 millennia old. Similarly, the New World has the only living cults based on use of dimethyltryptamine, DMT, the beta-carboline group including harmine, and the ergot-like complex in Morning Glories. A historical consequence of this clustering of hallucinogens in the New World was that Western science discovered their existence rather late. This may explain the absence of psychedelic input into Western drugs for psychiatric uses. Meanwhile, because of the influence of hashish and opium on the romantic imagination, the hashish reverie or opium dream became the paradigm of the action of the new mental drugs that fascinated the bohemian literati from the late 18th century on. Indeed, hallucinogens were seen as capable of mimicking psychoses in their early encounter with Western psychotherapy. In the 19th century, explorer naturalists began to return with more or less accurate ethnographic reports of the activities of Aboriginal peoples. Botanists Richard Spruce and Alfred Russel Wallace traveled in the Amazon drainage in the 1850s. On the upper reaches of the Rio Negro, Spruce observed a group of Indians prepare an unfamiliar hallucinogen. He further observed that the main ingredient for this intoxicant was a liana, a wood-climbing vine which he named Banisteria capi. Several years later, while traveling in western Ecuador, he saw the same plant being used to make a hallucinogen called ayahuasca. Ayahuasca has continued to the present day to be a part of the spiritual life of many of the tribes in the montane rainforest of South America. Immigrants into the Amazon basin have also accepted ayahuasca and have created their own ethnobotanical medical system for using the psychedelic visions it imparts to promote healing. The word ayahuasca is a Quechua word that roughly translates as vine of the dead or vine of souls. This term refers not only to the prepared hallucinogenic beverage, but also to one of its main ingredients, the woody liana. The tissues of this plant are rich in alkaloids of the beta-carboline type. The most important beta-carboline occurring in what is now called Banisteriopsis caapae is harmine. Harmine is an indole, but it is not overtly psychedelic unless taken in amounts that approach what is considered a toxic dose. However, well below that level, harmine is an effective short-acting monoamine oxidase inhibitor. Thus, a hallucinogen such as DMT, which would normally be inactive if taken orally, is rendered highly psychoactive if taken orally in combination with harmine. Native peoples of the Amazon region have brilliantly exploited these facts in their search for techniques to access the magical dimensions crucial to shamanism. By combining an ayahuasca, DMT-containing plants with plants that contain MAO inhibitors, they have long exploited a pharmacological mechanism, MAO inhibition, not described by Western science until the 1950s. In the presence of harmine, DMT becomes a highly psychoactive compound that enters the bloodstream and eventually makes its way past the blood-brain barrier and into the brain. There, it very effectively competes with serotonin for synaptic bonding sites. This experience of the slow release of DMT lasts 4 to 6 hours and is the basis of the magical and shamanic view of reality that characterizes the ayahuascaro and his or her circle of initiates. Uninvolved or so-called objective styles of anthropological reportage have tended to underemphasize the culture-shaping importance that these altered states have had for tribal Amazonian societies. The experience of ingesting ayahuasca, organic DMT taken in combination with a Banisteriopsis vine, has a number of characteristics that set it apart from the experience of smoking DMT. Ayahuasca is gentler and of much greater duration. Its themes and hallucinations are oriented toward the organic and the natural world, in marked contrast to the titanic, alien, and off-planet motifs that characterize the DMT flash. Why such major differences should exist between compounds that appear so structurally similar is an uninvestigated problem. Indeed, the whole relationship of particular kinds of visions to the compounds that elicit them is not well understood. In the native areas of its use, ayahuasca is regarded as a general-purpose healing elixir and is called La Purga, the purge. Its effectiveness in combating intestinal parasites has been proven. Its effectiveness in killing the malaria organism is now being investigated, and its long history of effective shamanic use in folk psychiatry has been documented by Naranjo, Dobkin de Rios, Luna, and others. Ayahuasca. The experience induced by ayahuasca includes extremely rich tapestries of visual hallucination that are particularly susceptible to being driven and directed by sound, especially vocally produced sound. Consequently, one of the legacies of the ayahuasca-using cultures is a large repository of icaros, or magical songs. The effectiveness, sophistication, and dedication of an ayahuascaro is predicated upon how many magical songs he or she has effectively memorized. In the actual curing sessions, both patient and healer ingest ayahuasca, and the singing of the magical songs is a shared experience that is largely visual. The impact of long-term use of hallucinogenic indoles on mental and physical health is not yet well understood. My own experiences among the mestizo populations of Amazonas convince me that the long-term effect of ayahuasca use is an extraordinary state of health and integration. Ayahuascaros use sound and suggestion to direct healing energy into parts of the body and unexamined aspects of an individual's personal history where psychic tension has come to rest. Often these methods exhibit startling parallels to the techniques of modern psychotherapy. At other times, they seem to represent an understanding of possibilities and energies still unrecognized by Western theories of healing. Most interesting from the point of view of the arguments made in this book are the persistent rumors of states of group mind or telepathy that occur among the less acculturated tribal peoples. Our history of skepticism and empiricism would have us dismiss such claims as impossible, but we should think twice before doing so. The chief lesson to be learned from the psychedelic experience is the degree to which unexamined cultural values and limitations of language have made us the unwitting prisoners of our own assumptions. For it cannot be without reason that wherever in the world hallucinogenic indoles have been utilized, their use has been equated with magical self-healing and regeneration. The low incidence of serious mental illness among such populations is well documented. The father of psychopharmacology. The modern era of psychopharmacology's interest in the aboriginal use of hallucinogenic plants has been extraordinarily brief. It dates to only a century ago, to German pharmacologist Louis Lewin's tour of the United States. On returning to Berlin in 1887, Lewin carried with him a quantity of peyote buttons, the vision-inducing cactus of the Sonoran Indians, that he had obtained from the Park Davis Company during his stay in Detroit. He set to work extracting, characterizing, and self-experimenting with the new compounds he discovered. Within a decade, peyote had attracted sufficient attention that in 1897 Philadelphia novelist and physician Silas Weir Mitchell became the first gringo to describe peyote intoxication. The display, which for an enchanted 2 hours followed, was such as I find it hopeless to describe in language, which shall convey to others the beauty and splendor of what I saw. Stars, delicate floating films of color, then an abrupt rush of countless points of white light swept across the field of view, as if the unseen millions of the Milky Way were to flow a sparkling river before the eyes, zigzag lines of very bright colors, the wonderful loveliness of swelling colors of more vivid colors gone before I could name them. Then, for the first time, definite objects associated with colors appear. A white spear of gray stone grew up to huge height and became a tall, richly finished Gothic tower of very elaborate and definite design, with many rather worn statues standing in the doorways or on stone brackets. As I gazed, every projecting angle, cornice, and even the faces of the stones at their joinings were by degrees covered or hung with clusters of what seemed to be huge precious stones, but uncut, some being like masses of transparent fruit. The Pleasures of Mescaline. In 1897, Arthur Hefter, a rival of Lewin's, became the first human being to isolate and ingest pure mescaline. Mescaline is a powerful visionary phenethylamine that occurs in the peyote cactus, Lophophora williamsii. It has been used for at least several centuries by the Indians of northern Mexico. Its use in Peru, where it is derived from species of cactus other than peyote, is at least several thousand years old. The psychologist and pioneer sexologist Havelock Ellis, following the example of Weir Mitchell, soon offered his own account of mescaline's pleasures. The visions never resembled familiar objects. They were extremely definite, yet always novel. They were constantly approaching and yet constantly eluding, the semblance of known things. I would see thick, glorious fields of jewels, solitary or clustered, sometimes brilliant and sparkling, sometimes with a dull, rich glow. Then they would spring up into flower-like shapes beneath my gaze, and then seem to turn into gorgeous butterfly forms or endless folds of glistening, iridescent, fibrous wings of wonderful insects. Monstrous forms, fabulous landscapes, etc. appear. It seems to us that any scheme which, in a detailed manner, assigns different kinds of visions to successive stages of the mescal state must be viewed as extremely arbitrary. The only thing that is typical with regard to sequence is that very elementary visions are followed by visions of a more complex character. Mescaline introduced experimenters to an agent of the paradis artificiel more potent than either cannabis or opium. Descriptions of mescaline states could hardly fail to attract the attention of the surrealists and psychologists, who also shared a fascination with the images hidden in the depths of the newly defined unconscious. Dr. Kurt Berringer, Lewin's student and an acquaintance of Hermann Hesse's and Carl Jung's, became the father of psychedelic psychiatry. His phenomenological approach stressed reportage of the internal vistas beheld. He conducted hundreds of experiments with mescaline in human beings. The accounts given by his subjects are fascinating. Then the dark room once more. The visions of fantastic architecture again took hold of me, endless passages in Moorish style, moving like waves alternated like astonishing pictures of curious figures. A design in the form of a cross was very frequent and present in unceasing variety. Incessantly the central lines of the ornament emanated, creeping like serpents or shooting forth like tongues toward the sides, but always in straight lines. Crystals appeared again and again, changing form and color, and in the rapidity with which they came before my eyes. Then the pictures grew more steady, and slowly two immense cosmic systems were created, divided by a kind of line into an upper and a lower half. Shining with their own light, they appeared in unlimited space. From the interior, new rays appeared in more luminescent colors, and gradually becoming perfect, they assumed the form of oblong prisms. At the same time, they began to move. The systems approaching each other were attracted and repelled. In 1927, Berenger published his magnum opus, Der Mescaline Rausch, translated into Spanish but never into English. It is an inspired work, and it set the stage for the science of investigative pharmacology. The following year saw the publication in English of Heinrich Kluver's Mescal, The Divine Plant and Its Psychological Effects. Kluver, whose work built on the observations of Weir Mitchell and Havelock Ellis, reintroduced the English-speaking world to the notion of visionary pharmacology. Especially important was the fact that Kluver took the hallucinogenic content of the experiences he was observing seriously and became the first to attempt to give a phenomenological description of the psychedelic experience. Clouds from left to right through optical field, tail of pheasant and center of field turns into bright yellow star, star into sparks, moving scintillating screw, hundreds of screws. A sequence of rapidly changing objects in agreeable colors, a rotating wheel, diameter about 1 centimeter, in the center of a silvery ground. Suddenly in the wheel a picture of God as represented in old Christian paintings, intention to see a homogeneous dark field of vision, red and green shoes appear. Most phenomena much nearer than reading distance. A modern renaissance. The investigation of hallucinogenic indoles also dates to the 1920s. A veritable renaissance of psychopharmacology was taking place in Germany. In this atmosphere, Lewin and others became interested in harmine, an indole whose only source was thought to be Banisteriopsis caapi, the woody liana encountered by Richard Spruce nearly 80 years before. Indeed, Lewin's last published work reflected his new fascination with caapi, entitled Banisteria caapi, ein neues Rauschgift und Heilmittel. It appeared in 1929. The excitement of Lewin and his colleagues was understandable. Ethnographers such as the German Theodor Koch Grünberg returned from Amazonas with accounts of tribes using telepathy-inducing plant drugs to direct the course of their societies. In 1927, the chemists E. Perot and M. Raymond Hammett isolated the active agent from Banisteriopsis caapi and named it telepathine. Years later, in 1957, researchers realized that telepathine was identical to the compound harmaline, extracted from Peganum harmala, and the name harmine was given official precedence over telepathine. In the 1930s, the enthusiasm for the harmala alkaloids by and large vanished, as did much of the interest in ethnopharmacology. There were, however, notable exceptions. Among them was an Austrian expatriate living in Mexico. Blas Pablo Rico, born Blasius Paul Rico, was a person of wide-ranging interests. His wandering life took him to the United States, to Ecuador, and finally to Oaxaca, Mexico. There he became interested in ethnobotany and what is today called archaeoastronomy, the study of ancient cultures' observations and attitudes toward the stars. Rico was an astute observer of the plant usages among the native people with whom he lived. In 1919, in rebuttal to an article by William Safford, Rico wrote that it was a hallucinogenic mushroom and not peyote that shamans of the Mixtec and Mazatecan people still used in a traditional way to induce visions. In 1937, Rico sent Henry Wasson, an anthropologist and the curator of the Ethnographical Museum in Gothenburg, Sweden, a package containing collections of two plants that Rico had found particularly interesting. One of the samples was Paiuli seed, the visionary morning glory seeds of Ipomoea violacea, which contain hallucinogenic indoles related to LSD. Rico's other sample, unfortunately too decomposed to be identified to species, was a fragment of Teonana cattle, the first specimen of a psilocybin-containing mushroom to be brought to scientific attention. Thus, Rico initiated the study of the indole hallucinogens of Mexico, and two chains of research and discovery, which would eventually be reunited when Albert Hofmann, the Swiss pharmaceutical chemist, characterized both compounds in his laboratory. Whispers of a New World Mushroom. Rico had obtained his mushroom sample from Roberto Whitelander, a European engineer working in Mexico. The following year, 1938, a small group including Whitelander's daughter and anthropologist Jean Bassett Johnson became the first whites to attend a night-long mushroom ceremony, or velada. Wasson eventually forwarded Rico's samples to Harvard, where they came to the attention of the young ethnobotanist Richard Evans Schultz. Schultz had been a medical student until he had happened upon Kluver's work on mescaline. Schultz believed that Rico's mushroom might be the mysterious Teonana cattle described by the Spanish chroniclers. He and an anthropology student from Yale, Weston Labar, published a summation of the evidence for Teonana cattle being a psychoactive mushroom. The next year found Schultz accompanying Rico to the village of Huatla de Jimenez in the Sierra Mazatecan Highlands. Specimens of psychoactive mushrooms were collected and forwarded to Harvard. But larger forces were afoot during the late 30s. Like research in many other areas, ethnobotanical research slowed to a stop as the world slipped into World War. Rico retired, and as the Japanese solidified their hold on the rubber plantations of Malaya, Schultz accepted an assignment to the Amazon basin to study rubber extraction for the U.S. government's wartime Office of Strategic Services. But before this, in 1939, he published The Identification of Teonana Cattle, a narcotic basidiomycete of the Aztecs. Here he quietly announced his correct solution to an enigma that at that time seemed no more than a matter of scholarly debate among Mesoamericanists. The invention of LSD. Yet, even as the lights were going out in Europe, a fundamental breakthrough occurred. In 1938, Albert Hofmann was engaged in routine pharmaceutical research at Sandoz Laboratories in Basel, Switzerland. Hofmann hoped to produce new drugs that would ease labor and childbirth. While working with a vasoconstricting substances derived from ergot, Hofmann synthesized the first D-lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate, LSD-25. Hofmann, a modest man, merely noted the correct completion of the synthesis, and the untested compound was cataloged and placed into storage. There it remained, surrounded by Nazi Europe for the next 5 years, five of the most tumultuous years in human history. It is frightening to imagine some of the possible consequences had Hofmann's discovery been recognized for what it was even a moment earlier. Alfred Jarry may have anticipated and allegorized the great event when he wrote The Passion Considered as an Uphill Bicycle Race in 1894. Indeed, the Dadaists and Surrealists and their forerunners grouped around Jarry, and his École du Pataphysique did much to explore the use of hashish and mescaline as augmentations to creative expression. They set the cultural stage for the truly surreal emergence of society's awareness of LSD. Every LSD enthusiast knows the story of how on April 16, 1943, feeling a touch of the Friday blahs and unaware that he had absorbed a dose of LSD through handling the chemical without gloves, chemist and soon-to-be counterculture hero Albert Hofmann left work early and set off on his bicycle through the streets of Basel. "I was forced to interrupt my work in the laboratory in the middle of the afternoon and proceed home, being affected by a remarkable restlessness combined with a slight dizziness. At home I lay down and sank into a not unpleasant intoxicated dreamlike condition characterized by an extremely stimulated imagination. In a dreamlike state, with eyes closed, I found the daylight to be unpleasantly glaring. I perceived an uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures, extraordinary shapes with intense kaleidoscopic play of colors. After some 2 hours, this condition faded away. Pandora's box flung open. Finally, in 1947, the news of Hofmann's extraordinary discovery, a mega-hallucinogen active in the microgram range, surfaced in the scientific literature. As events in the 1950s made clear, Pandora's box had been flung open. In 1954, Aldous Huxley wrote The Doors of Perception, a brilliant literary snapshot of the male European intellectual grappling with and agape at the realization of the true dimensions of consciousness and the cosmos. What the rest of us see only under the influence of mescaline, the artist is congenitally equipped to see all the time. His perception is not limited to what is biologically or socially useful. A little of the knowledge belonging to mind at large oozes past the reducing valve of brain and ego into his consciousness. It is a knowledge of the intrinsic significance of every existent. For the artist, as for the mescaline taker, draperies are living hieroglyphs that stand in some peculiarly expressive way for the unfathomable mystery of our being. More even than the chair, though less perhaps than those holy supernatural flowers, the folds of my gray flannel trousers were charged with isness. To what they owed this privileged status, I cannot say. In 1956, the Czech chemist Stephen Zara synthesized dimethyltryptamine, DMT. DMT remains the most powerful of all hallucinogens and one of the most short-acting of these compounds known. When DMT is smoked, the intoxication reaches a peak in about 2 minutes and then abates over about 10 minutes. Injections are typically more prolonged in their effect. Here's the discoverer's account. On the third or fourth minute after the injection, vegetative symptoms appeared, such as tingling sensations, trembling, slight nausea, mydriasis, elevation of the blood pressure, and increase of the pulse rate. At the same time, eidetic phenomena, optical illusions, pseudo-hallucinations, and later real hallucinations appeared. The hallucinations consisted of moving, brilliantly colored oriental motifs, and later I saw wonderful scenes altering very rapidly. A year later, in May 1957, Valentina and Gordon Wasson published their now-famous article in Life magazine announcing the discovery of the psilocybin mushroom complex. This article, as much as any other single piece of writing published on the subject, introduced into mass consciousness the notion that plants could cause exotic, perhaps even paranormal, visions. A New York investment banker, Wasson was well acquainted with the movers and shakers of the establishment. Therefore, it was natural that he should turn to his friend Henry Luce, publisher of Life, when he needed a public forum in which to announce his discoveries. The tone of the Life article contrasts sharply with the hysteria and distortion that the American media would later fan. The article is both fair and detailed, both open-minded and scientific. The chemical loose ends of the Wasson's discoveries were tidied up by Albert Hofmann, who made a second starring appearance in the history of psychedelic pharmacology by chemically isolating psilocybin and determining its structure in 1958. In the short space of a dozen years in the recent past, from 1947 until 1960, the major indole hallucinogens were characterized, purified, and investigated. It is no coincidence that the subsequent decade was the most turbulent decade in America in 100 years. LSD and the Psychedelic 60s. To understand the role of psychedelics in the 1960s, we must recall the lessons of prehistory and the importance to early human beings of the dissolution of boundaries in group ritual based on ingestion of hallucinogenic plants. The effect of these compounds is largely psychological and is only partially culturally conditioned. In fact, the compounds act to dissolve cultural conditioning of any sort. They force the corrosive process of reform of community values. Such compounds should be recognized as deconditioning agents. By revealing the relativity of conventional values, they become powerful forces in the political struggle to control the evolution of social images. The sudden introduction of a powerful deconditioning agent such as LSD had the effect of creating a mass defection from community values, especially values based on a dominator hierarchy accustomed to suppressing consciousness and awareness. LSD is unique among drugs in the power of its dose range. LSD is detectable in human beings at a dose of 50 micrograms, or 5/100,000 of a gram. Compounds that can elicit effects from amounts smaller than this are unheard of. This means that 10,000 doses of 100 micrograms each could in theory be obtained from one pure gram. More than any other aspect, this staggering ratio of physical mass to market value explains the meteoric rise of LSD use and its subsequent suppression. LSD is odorless and colorless, and it can be mixed in liquids. Hundreds of doses could be concealed under a postage stamp. Prison walls were no barrier to LSD, nor were national borders. It could be manufactured in any location with the necessary technology and immediately transported anywhere. Millions of doses of LSD could be and were manufactured by a very few people. Pyramidal markets formed around these sources of supply. Criminal syndicalism, a precondition to fascism, quickly followed. But LSD is more than a commodity. It is a commodity that dissolves the social machinery through which it moves. This effect has bedeviled all the factions that have sought to use LSD to advance a political agenda. A psychological deconditioning agent is inherently counter-agenda. Once the various parties attempting to gain control of the situation recognized this, they were able to agree on one thing, that LSD must be stopped. How and by whom this was done is a lively story that has been well told, most notably by J. Stevens in Storming Heaven and Martin Lee and Bruce Schlain in Acid Dreams. These authors make clear that when the methods that worked for colonial empires peddling opium in the 19th century were applied by the CIA to the internal management of the American state of mind during the Vietnam War, they damn near blew up the whole psychosocial shithouse. Lee and Schlain write, "The use of LSD among young people in the U.S. reached a peak in the late 1960s, shortly after the CIA initiated a series of covert operations designed to disrupt, discredit, and neutralize the new left. Was this merely a historical coincidence, or did the agency actually take steps to promote the illicit acid trade? Not surprisingly, CIA spokesmen dismiss such a notion out of hand. We do not target American citizens," former CIA Director Richard Helms told the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1971. "The nation must, to a degree, take it on faith that we who lead the CIA are honorable men, devoted to the nation's service." Helms' reassurances are hardly comforting in light of his own role as the prime instigator of Operation MK Ultra, which utilized unwitting Americans as guinea pigs for testing LSD and other mind-altering substances. As it turns out, nearly every drug that appeared on the black market during the 1960s, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, PCP, amyl nitrate, mushrooms, DMT barbiturates, laughing gas, speed, and many others, had previously been scrutinized, tested, and in some cases refined by CIA and Army scientists. But of all the techniques explored by the agency in its multi-million-dollar 25-year quest to conquer the human mind, none received as much attention or was embraced with such enthusiasm as LSD-25. For a time, CIA personnel were completely infatuated with a hallucinogen. Those who first tested LSD in the early 1950s were convinced that it would revolutionize the cloak-and-dagger trade. During Helms's tenure as CIA director, the agency conducted a massive illegal domestic campaign against the anti-war movement and other dissident elements in the U.S. As a result of Helms' successful campaign, the New Left was in shambles when Helms retired from the CIA in 1973. Most of the official records pertaining to the CIA's drug and mind control projects were summarily destroyed on orders from Helms shortly before his departure. The files were shredded, according to Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, chief of the CIA's technical services staff, because of a burgeoning paper problem. Lost in the process were numerous documents concerning the operational employment of hallucinogenic drugs, including all existing copies of a classified CIA manual titled LSD, Some Unpsychedelic Implications. The times were extraordinary, made only more so by the fantasies of those who sought to control them. The 1960s can almost be seen as a time when two pharmacological mindsets clashed in an atmosphere close to that of war. On the one hand, international heroin syndicates sought to narcotize America's black ghettos while hoodwinking the middle class into supporting military adventurism. On the other, self-organized criminal syndicates manufactured and distributed tens of millions of doses of LSD while waging a highly visible underground campaign for their own brand of psychedelic crypto-anarchy. The result of this encounter can be seen as something of a standoff. The war in Southeast Asia was a catastrophic defeat for the American establishment, yet paradoxically, barely a shred of psychedelic utopianism survived the encounter. All psychedelic drugs, even such unknowns as ibogaine and bufotenin, were made illegal. A relentless restructuring of values was begun in the West. Throughout the 70s and 80s, the need to deny the impact of the 60s took on something of the flavor of a mass obsession. As the 70s progressed, the new management agenda became clear. While heroin had lost some of its glamour, now there was to be television for the poor and cocaine for the rich. By the end of the 1960s, psychedelic research had been hounded out of existence, not only in the United States, but around the world. And this happened despite the enormous excitement these discoveries had created among psychologists and students of human behavior, an excitement analogous to the feeling that swept the physics community at the news of the splitting of the atom. But whereas the power of the atom, convertible into weapons of mass destruction, was fascinating to the dominator establishment, the psychedelic experience loomed ultimately as an abyss. The new era of repression came despite the fact that a number of researchers were using LSD to cure conditions previously considered untreatable. Canadian psychiatrists Abram Hoffer and Humphrey Osmond tabulated the results of 11 separate studies of alcoholism and concluded that 45% of the patients treated with LSD improved. Promising results were obtained in attempts to treat schizophrenics, autistic children, and the severely depressed. Many of these findings were attacked after LSD became illegal, but better experiments were never designed, and the work could not be repeated because of its illegality. Psychiatry's promising new uses of LSD to treat pain, addiction, alcoholism, and depression during terminal illness were put on indefinite hold. It fell to the humble science of botany to advance our understanding of hallucinogenic plants. Richard Schultz and the plant hallucinogens. At the center of this quiet revolution in botany was a single man, Richard Evans Schultz, the same Schultz who had seen his Mexican research interrupted by World War II. Schultz spent more than 15 years in the Amazon basin. He filed reports with the OSS on the natural rubber crop until the invention of synthetic rubber made that task unnecessary, and he studied and collected the orchids of the rainforest in the Altiplano. As Schultz traveled, it became clear that his interest in Kluver's experiments with mescaline and his fascination with the psychoactive plants of Mexico would not be wasted in South America. Years later, he would write of his work among the shamans of the Simbundoy Valley of southern Colombia. The shamanism of this valley may well represent the most highly evolved narcotic consciousness on Earth. What was true of the Simbundoy was nearly as true of the upper Amazon generally, and over the next several decades it was Schultz and his graduate students who practiced and spread the gospel of modern ethnobotany. Schultz focused on psychoactive plants from the beginning of his work. He correctly recognized that Aboriginal people who had painstakingly composed an armamentarium of healing and medicinal plants were likely to most clearly understand their mental effects. After his early work on peyote and mushrooms, Schultz turned his attention to the several species of vision-inducing morning glories used in Oaxaca. In 1954, he published on the snuffs of the Amazon and thus announced to the world the existence of traditional shamanic usage of plant-produced DMT. Throughout the next 35 years, the Harvard group meticulously investigated and published all instances of psychoactive plant usage that came to their attention. This body of now continuously expanding work, an integrated body of taxonomic, ethnographic, pharmacological, and medical information, constitutes the core of the database currently in global use. The birth of ethnopsychopharmacology took place at Harvard under Schultz's watchful eye, much of it during the turbulent years when Timothy Leary was also at Harvard and attracting a very different sort of reputation through his own effort to place the psychedelic experience on the social agenda. Leary at Harvard. It is doubtful that either Leary or Schultz saw much to like in the other. They could hardly have been more different. Schultz, the reticent Brahmin, scholar and botanist-scientist, Leary, the shamanic trickster and social scientist. Leary's earliest psychedelic experience had been with mushrooms. You would later recall that he was recruited for what he called my planetary mission by that first psilocybin encounter in Mexico. But the politics of expediency were forced on the Harvard psilocybin project. LSD was more accessible and less expensive than psilocybin. Michael Hollingshead was the person most responsible for making LSD the drug of choice in Harvard psychedelic circles. Leary latched on to Hollingshead as his guru. Leary followed him around for days on end. Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner, two of Leary's closest associates, were vexed to see him in such a helpless state. They thought he had really blown his mind, and they blamed Hollingshead. But it was only a matter of time before they too sampled the contents of the mayonnaise jar. Hollingshead gave the drug to the members of the psilocybin project, and from then on, LSD was part of their research repertoire. Psilocybin, psychedelics in the 70s. After the suppression of the psychedelic subculture that began with the illegalization of LSD in October 1966, the evolution of substance sophistication seemed to lose momentum. The most significant development during the 1970s, from the point of view of those alerted to the psychedelic potential by earlier experiences with LSD and mescaline, was the appearance, beginning in late 1975, of techniques and manuals for the home cultivation of psilocybin mushrooms. Several such manuals appeared, the earliest being Psilocybin, The Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide, written by my brother and me and published pseudonymously under the names O.T. Oss and O.N. Oreck. The book sold over 100,000 copies over the next 5 years, and several imitators also did very well. Hence, psilocybin, long sought and long familiar to the psychedelic community through the effusive prose of Wasson and Leary, became available at last to large numbers of people who no longer needed to travel to Oaxaca to obtain the experience. The ambience of psilocybin is different from that of LSD. Hallucinations come easier, and so does a sense that this is not merely a lens for the inspection of the personal psyche, but a communication device for getting in touch with the world of the high shamanism of archaic antiquity. A community of therapists and astronauts of inner space has evolved around the use of the mushrooms. To this day, these quiet groups of professionals and inner pioneers constitute the core of the community of people who have admitted the fact of the psychedelic experience into their lives and professions and who continue to grapple with it and learn from it. And there we will leave the history of human involvement with plants that intoxicate or bring visions or consuming frenzy. We now know no more really than was known by our remote ancestors, perhaps less. Indeed, we cannot even be certain whether science, the epistemic tool upon which we have come to depend most heavily, is up to this task. For we can begin our quest for understanding in the cool domains of archaeology or botany or neuropharmacology, but what is troubling and miraculous is the fact that all these approaches, when seen with psychedelic eyes, seem to lead to the internal nexus of self and world that we experience as the deepest levels of our own being. Psychedelic implications. What does it mean that pharmacology's effort to reduce the mind to molecular machinery confined within the brain has handed back to us a vision of mind that argues for its almost cosmic proportions? Drugs seem the potential agents of both our devolution back into the animal and our metamorphosis into a shining dream of possible perfection. "Man to man is like unto an errant beast," wrote the English social philosopher Thomas Hobbes, "and man to man is like unto a god." To this we might add, and never more so than when using drugs. The 1980s were an era unusually empty of developments in the area of psychedelics. Synthetic amphetamines such as MDA were sporadically available from the early 1970s on, and during the 1980s, MDMA, ecstasy, appeared in significant amounts. MDMA in particular showed promise when used with directed psychotherapy, but these drugs were quickly made illegal and forced underground before they achieved any general impact on society. MDMA was simply the most recent echo of the search for inner balance that drives ever-shifting styles of drug use and inner exploration. The drug terror of the 1980s was crack cocaine, a drug whose economic profile and high risk for addiction made it ideal in the eyes of the already established infrastructure for supplying the ordinary cocaine market. The costs of drug education and drug treatment are small relative to routine military expenditures and could be contained. What cannot be contained are the effects that psychedelics would have in shaping the cultural self-image if all drugs were legal and available. This is the hidden issue that makes governments unwilling to consider legalization, the unmanaged shift of consciousness that legal and available drugs, including plant psychedelics, would bring, is extremely threatening to a dominator, ego-oriented culture. Public awareness of the problem. To this point, public awareness of issues concerning drugs has been lacking and public opinion easily manipulated. The situation must change. We must prepare to master the problem of our relationship to psychoactive substances. This cannot be done by an appeal to some anti-human standard of behavior that spells more suppression of the mass psyche by dominator metaphors. There can be no saying no to drugs. Nothing so asinine or preposterous will do. Nor can we be led down the primrose path by feel-good philosophies that see unbridled hedonism as the holy grail of social organization. Our only reasonable course is decriminalization of drugs, mass education, and shamanism as an interdisciplinary and professional approach to these realities. It is our souls that have become ill when we abuse drugs, and the shaman is a healer of souls. Such measures will not immediately solve the general drug problem, but they will preserve the sorely needed pipeline to the spirit that we must have if we expect to restructure society's attitude toward plant and substance use and abuse. An interrupted psychophysical symbiosis between ourselves and the visionary plants is the unrecognized cause of the alienation of modernity and the cultural mindset of planetary civilization. A worldwide attitude of fear toward drugs is being fostered and manipulated by the dominator culture and its propaganda organs. Vast illicit fortunes continue to be made. Government continues to wring its hands. This is but the most recent effort to profiteer from and frustrate our species' deeply instinctual need to make contact with the Gaian mind of the living planet.